I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardine, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started La Bernardine in 1986 with her brother Gilbert after operating the restaurant with the same name in Paris. When Gilbert died from a heart attack in 1994, Eric Ripert took over as the restaurant's co-owner and chef. Maggie and Eric are co-authors of La Bernardine Cookbook. La Bernardine has been awarded 3 Michelin stars and has held 4 stars from the New York Times since it opened. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are your earliest memories of eating fish?
Oh, from the very beginning, I didn't like meat. So that was easy. When I was very young, 3-4 years old, I was eating in the dining room in our little hotel restaurant in Brittany with my brother, and we were eating fish.
So you lived in Brittany, and your parents operated a small hotel restaurant. How involved were you in the restaurant? What roles did you have?
We were involved very early, like peeling potatoes. We were stuffing clams. We were 7 or 8 years old. I was in the dining room with my mother, and my brother was in the kitchen with my father. And then my father had this idea, as he had 2 grown-up kids, to open a disco.
Tell me about the disco. This is now in the 1960s?
Yes, and it was one of the first disco in Brittany, so we were very successful, but we didn't know how to make money. And then later on, my brother was in his early 20s, he was working as in a disco in Paris. And then he really learned how to make money.
What kind of music played in the disco at the time?
The music of the Rolling Stone.
And your grandfather was a fisherman. Do you recall going out with him to catch fish?
Not me. I didn't like too much going on the boat, but my brother really liked doing that. And he preferred to go on the boat with my grandfather than to go to school, to tell you the truth. He was very young when he started to go on the boat with him. And one day there was a tempest that raised very quickly, and they had to tie him up with ropes to prevent him to be thrown away off the boat.
Did you both know from the early days that you wanted to go into business together and open a restaurant together? How did that happen?
Not at all. I wanted to be a stewardess, and my brother wanted to work on boats, but the kind of big boats where they go far away.
Cargo?
Yes, cargo.
Ah. Why did you want to be a stewardess?
Because I wanted to get out of Brittany and travel. That was it. I knew early in my life that I would not stay in Brittany. It was too remote, and I knew that there was a life somewhere else.
Eventually, you and your brother moved to Paris.
Yes.
But before opening the restaurant, you dabbled in different areas for a few years. What are some of the things that you did?
I modeled for a couple of years. Then I was a receptionist in an hotel. Then I was a hostess in a restaurant. And every year, we would come back to Brittany to help our parents.
How did you both then make the decision to open the restaurant?
Because there was nothing else that we knew. We didn't know that it was going to be so difficult, because the small training that we had in that small hotel restaurant was not enough to make a success in Paris. So we opened that restaurant in Paris in 72 with the help of everyone, friends, family, loan at the bank. It was a disaster. We didn't know how to run the restaurant to make money. We were having fun being outside every night after when the restaurant was closed. And several times we thought that we would we had to file for bankruptcy.
Your restaurant was almost taken away at one point.
That's right.
What is the story behind that?
One day I went for whatever reason to the market with my brother. And we came back with the small car full of fish, and we saw a notice on the window, for sale. This is our restaurant, this is us. And said, so I called the number and a man came. He said, all right, young lady, I'm going to help you. Can we sit somewhere? I said, yes, please come to my apartment. It's above the restaurant. He said, I'm going to help you. We can just take a lean on your furniture. What do you have? Here, I have one table, which is my desk, and two chairs. And I have my bedroom. I have my bed, and that's it. He said, that's the only thing I cannot take. So it's to show you how difficult it has been.
But despite this difficulty initially, you were actually opening a restaurant at an auspicious moment. Your brother, who was a chef with no formal training, benefited from a new experimentation going on in the French culinary community at the time. What impact do you think that had on your brother's cooking?
It was the beginning of the nouvelle cuisine. He tried to have some imagination. All the chefs were trying new way to get out of that heavy French cooking. So it was, in a way, the right time. He became friendly with all the chefs of his generation, went to have dinner with them, started to travel with them. They were always invited everywhere in France, whether it's to taste the truffles that were coming out or to taste wine. That's when everything started to come in his mind, I suppose.
And the first restaurant was called Le Bernardin.
Was called Le Bernardin, yes.
What does that mean?
It is a song that our father was singing to us called Les Moines de Saint Bernardin. Those monks were well known for the good life. They liked to eat and to drink. And that first location was on the left bank, not far from the restaurant that we were going to open. So we named the restaurant after those monks.
So you're talking about monks in a monastery? There's a monastery,
yes,
close to you? And monks obviously are known for their asceticism.
Yes, not those one.
I see. And so your father would sing this song to,
yes,
you growing up?
Yes. It's a well-known song.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started Le Bernardin in 1986 with her brother, Gilbert.
You operated the Paris restaurant from 1972 to 1987 in two locations.
Yes.
And the impetus for your closing the restaurant in Paris was that you opened up a New York restaurant.
Exactly.
In 1986.
Yes.
Why did you decide to move to New York?
It's very difficult to say because I didn't know New York. It's out of the blue. I was pushed by I don't know what or who, but it was very strong. And I started in the 1980 already to think about New York. I came once with my brother and we stayed 2 weeks. And my brother said, there is nothing here. There is no good vegetable. There is no herb. There is nothing. We cannot open a restaurant. And I told him, you are a coward. But he said, no way, we are not ready, and this town is not ready. We cannot do it. So a few years later, I told him, I don't want to stay here all my life. You will be 50 years old with a big belly behind your stove, and I will be with white hair at the entrance. I told him, I don't want a family, I'm not interested. I just want to run another business.
So you're eager to open a restaurant in New York, your brother not so much. What next? You tried a few times to start a restaurant, but investors repeatedly fell through.
It took me several times. One time I thought that I had everything. I had 10 different investment partner friends. And at the last minute, there was always one who would say no. And one year, I came back and I had almost a nervous breakdown because a deal didn't go through.
And then finally, a partnership randomly came together with essentially a stranger in New York City. You met Mr. Holloway, who was the head of Equitable.
Yes, he was the chairman of Equitable.
And Equitable is the real estate company that owns the building that you've been in.
Yes.
How did you meet him?
We met him through a friend of mine, whose brother was a very good friend of Ben Holloway. And he knew that he was finishing that huge building on the west side, which was not at that time a very well-known location.
155 West 51st Street.
So we went to his house. We opened a bottle of Dom Pérignon. We shook hands, said, that's it, we have a deal. Do you have an architect? Yes, we do. Tell your architect to get in touch with the architect of the building tomorrow. Do you have a lawyer? Yes, we do. Tell your lawyer to get in touch with the lawyer of the building and let's work on him. I said, but we don't have a deal. He said, we'll work on that. So they started to build the restaurant. We signed the deal 6 months later. He had so much trust and confidence with us that he knew that we were going to do it.
What was the restaurant landscape at the time in that neighborhood in Midtown?
It was not a good neighborhood. At night, we had some of our employees who were mugged. Nobody thought that it could be a right location, and we thought that it was going to be a right location because we were next to Rockefeller Center and next to Broadway.
But it was kind of accidental that you launched in this neighborhood.
Yes, that's right, because we had a very good deal.
How did you get financing from the beginning? Even you had Equitable as your landlord.
Yes.
But did they provide the capital to get the restaurant off the ground?
It was a turnkey operation.
A turnkey operation?
Yes, meaning that they would do all the work and then buy table, chairs, china, glassware, everything.
Lucky you.
Yes.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin. We'll hear more from Maggie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. She partnered with celebrity chef Eric Rappaire after Gilbert died in 1994. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Now, your brother came to New York kicking and screaming because it
yes.
was your wish. Did you ever think that maybe you and your brother should part ways because you wanted to be in New York and he wanted to be in Paris?
Well, no, we were very, very close and that was enough.
Your brother was protesting that there are no good herbs and no good vegetables. Where did he find or where did you both find the produce and the fish for your restaurant in Midtown?
The good thing was that New York is on the water, so Gilbert figured out that some fish were going to come to New York. He just had to find where to find them. He went to the Fulton Fish Market, was the first restaurateur ever going to the fish market. That was very interesting because he made the fish market discovered by the journalist who came with him, and then the TV went with him to the fish market, and suddenly the fish market has been known, and then the fishmonger was happy to be on TV, so we were treated very well with them.
So your brother brought publicity to Fulton Fish Market
yes.
because journalists and the TV crew would follow your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your brother did not speak English very well.
Gilbert didn't speak English. So his way to connect with them was just pointing out the fish and just pointing out the fish that they wanted to sell, which is no good. He said, he would say, no, no good. And that was it. And after a while, they understood that he really knew how to choose the fish.
So your brother was an expert in fish thanks to his family upbringing.
Yes, thanks to my grandfather, who was the fisherman.
And when you were first launching the restaurant in 1986, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
We could not find waiters. So we took our maitre d' from Paris with us, and the dining room became a school for 1 month. And we had at that time the biggest kitchen in New York. We had the first page of the New York Times with a picture of the kitchen. And we were serving dinner every night in the kitchen to train the waiters. And then we started to train waiters in the dining room, like having just 5 or 6 tables and increasing every day. And we had no publicity, no public relation to help us, just people would see that there was light and that they heard that the Bernardin was opening, and they would knock at the door and say, when are you going to be open? We said, we don't know, when we will be ready. And one night, Gilbert said, okay, we'll be ready soon. Maggie, you get 50 people in the dining room and nothing else for 1 month.
Do you remember what was on the menu the first night when you opened?
We had raw fish on the menu. Nobody in New York had eaten raw fish except in a few sushi places. So I would take the order at the table with the maitre d' and convince people to try to take the raw fish. And I would say, please, try it. And if you don't like it, we'll give you something else. There was a lot of tuna in New York. And the tuna, when it's too cooked, it's not good at all. So I said to my brother, listen, why don't we serve it raw? So we had carpaccio of tuna. We had some raw fish marinated that we serve on green salad. We had sea urchin, which was not very popular. So we had a sea urchin in a butter of sea urchin. We had oyster, of course. We had oyster with truffle, which was very unusual as well. We had fish soup. We had skate.
Squid.
Yes. We had served monkfish, which was not very well known either, that we would serve with leeks.
All that on the first night?
Oh, yes. When we were ready, we were ready. And every week, I would increase a little bit.
Now, your responsibilities were always split between your being in the front of the house and his always being the chef. Did you ever try to cook yourself?
No, I never tried because I never had the opportunity. That was not the tradition in the 50s and 60s to have women in the dining room. It was women in the front and men in the kitchen.
You mentioned that your brother had no traditional training and
That's right. He
was really more of an artist and he used his imagination. How did that help him in the kitchen, do you think, versus having a formal training?
Because our food was different, was very light. There was some broth, then emulsion.
Emulsion.
Yes. Spices, herbs. His menu was simple, but that's what was important because then really people started to appreciate the fish. And the fish was so fresh that it was really good.
You mentioned green salad, that you served fish on top of green salad.
Yes. Oh, that was a big deal.
What was Gilbert's relationship with salad?
Oh, a nightmare. Because we had customer coming and asking for a green salad. And he says, no, we are not serving green salad. I said, why not? Because you are in the restaurant, it's a fish restaurant, and I don't go to the fish market every night to serve a green salad. That was it. We would not serve green salad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Incidentally, when exactly did you open the restaurant to the public?
The restaurant was ready by November 1985. We knew that it was not the right time to open in the middle of the season, but we opened in January, which had always been successful for us. All the restaurants that we opened in January.
What were some of the mistakes you made in the early days of the restaurant?
I don't think we made mistakes. We were strong enough not to open the restaurant and to accept a lot of customers the first 2 months. So when Gail Green, who was the first person who reviewed the restaurant, came, the restaurant was ready. Her friends was telling her, you must go to the restaurant, it's really good. She said, I promised them not to go before they tell me that they are ready. So finally she came, and Brian Miller came right away.
Brian Miller of the New York Times.
Yes.
Which gave you 4 stars.
4 stars, which was a big deal for him because it was at the beginning of him being at the New York Times, and it was the first 4 star that he gave. In his first article that he did, he said, I wish that we can take their passport so that they don't go back to France. And suddenly we were overwhelmed with the phones. We couldn't answer the phones. We had 5 persons on the reservation, and it was not enough. We had to buy a sophisticated answering machine to take over. Nobody could reach us. It was very special. It was special days.
When you got your 4 stars from the New York Times,
yes.
Do you remember that moment when you found out?
Yes, we found out because by coincidence, we had that night friends coming from France, and I said, you arrive right on time. Tonight we are going to see what we are going to get with the New York Times. The manager came at that moment with plenty of New York Times in his hands and threw away the newspaper in the restaurant.
The manager threw the newspaper in the air.
Absolutely. And in the private room, we had a reservation. It was 15 people. And they were all people from the New York Times. They all came down the stairs. And everybody was applauding.
Oh.
And everyone in the restaurant started to understand. So everyone started to applaud, and it was really a wonderful moment. And then we went outside to celebrate. When we came back, we called our father and explained him. And he said, so, you didn't go to the Fulton Fish Market this morning, my son?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants.
Your brother Gilbert passed away in 1994 from a heart attack?
From a heart attack, yes.
Was it sudden? Was it?
Yes, it was sudden, but not really. A year before, he had a kind of a small attack. At night, he woke up and his girlfriend, she rushed him to the hospital. And 3 days later, he asked the maître d' and Eric and the manager to come to the hospital with the mail. And in front of them, he took all the tube that he had in his hand. He said, I am fine. And don't say anything to my sister or you will be fired.
So he took out all the tubes, all the needles and tubes from the hospital?
Yes. If I had known, I would have battled and fight with him so that to do the test. He was supposed to do tests that he never did.
So your brother kept his heart attack a secret so you wouldn't worry and force him to undergo a series of tests?
Yes.
Eric Repair, your now chef and co-owner,
yes,
came on board, took over in 1994 when your brother passed away. Eric had been working in the kitchen with Gilbert.
With Gilbert, yes.
What was that relationship like?
Gilbert was very friendly with Jean-Louis Paladin, a very well-known chef who was running a restaurant in the Watergate Hotel in Washington. He's the first French chef who came to United States. And Gilbert asked him if he had someone that he could recommend because he knew that that could not go further than what he has done, that he really need new blood. And Jean-Louis Paladin introduced him to my brother. And Eric, it took like a few months before Eric accepted it. They were meeting every Saturday at breakfast and talked about everything. They became friends before they became the chef of the restaurant.
Now, Eric's style of cooking is very different from your brother's. Gilbert was more ad hoc and there was no formal education, whereas Eric is well-schooled.
Oh, yes. Eric has the best training.
How is that manifested in the menu? How is the menu different as a result of now having Eric on board versus Gilbert?
When Gilbert died, I said to Eric, Eric, we have to stop. Don't do it at all, anything that Gilbert was doing, except the raw fish. We'll keep that, and everything has to be new.
How come?
Because I wanted to really to show that I should no longer think of my brother, and that Eric was a chef, and that he was talented, and that I wanted to show his talent.
I could see it going the other way. I could see some owners saying, I want you to continue in my brother's tradition. So it was probably freeing for Eric to have that
yes.
license from you.
Yes, definitely.
When the reviewers came to review the restaurant under Eric's auspices,
yes.
what were the
It was Ruth Reichel in 1995.
And?
Four stars.
Four stars.
Yes.
New York Times. Are you tearing up because this
yes.
is emotional for you?
Absolutely. It's 40 years of my life. But I have Eric and I. We are very close. We are like friends. I consider him like more than a business partner. He's my family. He's like my brother in a sense.
And Eric is really the public face of the restaurant to some degree. The star of a TV series called Avec Eric,
yes.
and a judge on Top Chef. How do you feel about his taking on that role with the restaurant, whereas you're more not behind the scenes because you're in from the front of the restaurant, but you certainly don't have your own TV series and you're not the one that has as much fame as he.
It's wonderful. I can go away whenever I want. And nobody is asking for me. Everybody is asking for Eric. It doesn't make a difference if I am there or not because I have a computer everywhere I go. I do the administration work in the restaurant. So every day I speak with everyone and I look at the numbers and that's fine.
Now, how has your job changed from the inception, from 1986 when you opened to now? What does your job entail?
In 1986, I was in the front. I was at the podium greeting people and then going to one table to the other, seeing if everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And then I would be in the restaurant from 6 o'clock to midnight, saying goodbye to the last customer. Plus the work in the office, it was very long days.
How has your clientele's taste changed from the beginning of the restaurant's opening till now?
They are very sophisticated now, yes. I don't remember, but what I can tell you is in one night we could have 15 tables taking tasting menus with wine pairing. So it means that the clientele is really sophisticated. They know about food.
There are so many restaurateurs expanding and having 2, 3, 5, 10 restaurants, whether they're all in New York or in other states. How come you're sticking with Le Bernardin only?
This is our choice. We like to be unique. When the customer comes, we want that experience to be very special. We always manage to be in the restaurant, either Eric or me, so that the customer can have that special experience. If they want to meet with us, we are there.
What is your diet like? What did you eat for breakfast this morning?
I eat cornflakes with skim milk, grapefruit that the restaurant prepare for me, and Greek yogurt. And lunch, it's green salad with vegetables and fruits.
How often are you eating in the restaurant?
Every day, lunch and dinner. And dinner, I pick up everything from the menu. I taste everything. And I sit down in the dining room and I want to be served like a customer. That's where I see the details.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. Coming up, we'll meet Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentic. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Nous sommes les moines de Saint-Bernardin.
Nous sommes les moines de Saint-Bernardin.
Nous nous couchons tard et nous levons matin.
Nous nous couchons tard et nous levons matin.
Pour aller à Matine, vider quelques flacons. Voilà ce qui est bon et bon, bon, bon.
Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentic, a company that makes fingerprint sensors that could unlock mobile phones and computers. Authentic was sold to Apple in 2012 for $356 million, and the fingerprint sensor first appeared on the iPhone 5S in 2013. Scott is also the co-founder of K4 Connect, a company that helps users integrate disparate technologies into one platform. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Jessica. It's great to be here.
So you worked at Harris Semiconductor for 18 years. You had some colleagues who introduced the idea of a fingerprint sensor technology to you. Can you talk about that moment when you first came into contact with this idea?
There was a guy that worked for me, Nick Van Vano. He set up a meeting, wanted to introduce me to this other guy named Dale Setlack. You know, this was back a while ago, the, you know, late 1990s, and I think we still wore suits or at least ties into work most days. And here comes Dale. You know, Dale has long hair in a ponytail. He's a little bit bald on top. And, you know, he's wearing a nose ring. And I'm just like, who is this guy? They presented this idea of a fingerprint sensor. I'll be honest, Jessica, I didn't really think it was a great idea. But Nick, who I knew exceedingly well, thought it could work. Dale convinced me he was an incredibly smart guy. And I really saw the whole idea of passwords starting to be a problem. So we actually started a research project around that very idea.
Was the biometrics area a busy place? I mean, you have companies creating products to read your eyes. How big was that space at the time?
So in terms of actual dollars that people were spending outside of government, it was exceedingly small. In terms of the people that said they could do something, there was a lot. There was probably 50 or 60 fingerprint sensor companies out there.
And what was it about your specific technology that made you think that you were different from those other companies?
We truly had a better technology. You know, technically, all of them really were looking at the surface layer of your finger. So if your finger was dry, or particularly if you were older, it actually had a number of issues. You know, as you get older, your skin becomes more supple. That's why we all have wrinkles. And so actually, when you put your finger down on a lot of the surface-based sensors, the ridges of your fingerprint would collapse into the valleys, and all you'd see was a big black blob. And so what we developed was something, at least at the time, we had brand named TruePrint. It was this RF, or radio frequency field, that read through the outer layer of your finger to your, what we referred to as your live layer, right, where your true fingerprint resides. In fact, if you sand down your finger to, you know, basically it's nice and smooth, it'll grow back exactly, you know, the same way.
While you were interested, finally, Harris Semiconductor, the company that you were all with, was not interested in pursuing the idea, and you licensed the technology from Harris and then started this on your own. Was that a tough conversation or separation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first off, I was quitting a pretty good job to mm-hmm. go start this other company. At the same time, Harris Corporation, the parent company, was exceedingly supportive. They actually helped fund the company to start.
Now, you had some failed demos. There are some stories of, you know, you're presenting to the chief technology officer at IBM and your technology not working. Can you provide one or two examples?
There's definitely demo hell, right? So the one you talked about, I was meeting with the CTO for IBM. So he sees the demo on the other side of the room. He puts his finger right down on the fingerprint sensor, and it says, "Hello, Dale Setlack." And, of course, is the co-founder and our CTO. So I was joking, like, you know, well, it recognized you as a CTO, you know. So incredibly embarrassing. There was another one with Phoenix Technology, the BIOS for PCs. We were in a very small room, and I was set it up on a separate table in the corner. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the system yells, "Access denied." And I'm telling you, it sounded so loud in that little room, and I ignored it. I was pretending like I didn't even see it. He's looking at me as I'm giving my pitch, like, is there something wrong? 2 minutes later, it does it again. So, of course, at that point, I had to admit there was a little bit of a problem. But you definitely feel, again, what people refer to as that demo hell.
Tell me briefly about just your impressions of raising capital.
Here's the thing about startups. Everybody tells you who funded the company. What they don't tell you usually is all the people that rejected you. So to me, raising money, honestly, is like the guy on the side of the road with a cardboard sign asking for money. 98% of the cars drive by and don't do anything. You know, 1.5% throw something at you or give you the finger. And 0.5% stop and give you money. You beg.
I want to talk about some of your early prototypes. Some of them didn't work very well. Can you tell me about that?
So, you know, when our first product came out, it didn't work, our first prototype. And I mean, it didn't not, like, work well. It, like, freaking didn't work. So that night we called the entire team together, and it was probably like 7 o'clock at night. I asked the question, how many people don't think we're going to make it? 20 people in the room, I think 15 of them raised their hands. And Jessica, I would have raised my hand, but I didn't think it would look good because I was the CEO, right? Talk about it, gave a rah-rah speech. And then, of course, as is important in any startup, we all went out and had some drinks. So the next day, come back in, we map out the plan, gave another rah-rah talk. And then again, we went out drinking. So that second night, I can remember going home. And I hardly ever talk about work at home. But that night, you know, I remember sitting down in our living room with my wife, and I was just like rambling on. I was just like, honey, I am so sorry. You know, I quit a good job. You know, we have the 3 kids. You know, I've ruined our life. I was just whining like crazy. And I'm pretty sure my wife probably said something in those 2 hours, but I don't remember it, right? Because I was so busy whining. But I do remember this, Jessica. It's like at the end of the conversation, my wife said to me, "You know what you need to do, so just go do it." You know, my wife could have turned around and said, "Yeah, you're right. You know, we need the money. You know, go get a job." But she didn't. Had she not said that night, Authentech may not have gone forward. So it was an incredibly important moment in my life.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentech, the company that made the fingerprint scanning technology on your Apple iPhone. You worked a lot with dermatologists in developing the technology. How are they helpful to you?
Really, the whole idea was to understand the various conditions of the skin. What I really gained experience on was outside, let's say, the dermatologist than actually testing. So we would go to construction sites, mm-hmm. right, to test, you know, people that were used to working with their hands mm-hmm. because they're all scarred up. They may be worn down. We would go to retirement communities. We would go to a lot of different places where, you know, there were populations that maybe have, you know, a different finger than I did as, you know, back then.
Before you and Apple connected, you were focused on not just the iPhone or the mobile phone market, but computers. And what other instruments were you looking to get this technology integrated in?
So in the beginning of the company, we really had this idea, look, let's go develop the technology. And it has application in a lot of different markets. It can be, you know, for automotive, PCs, cell phones. But when we really saw that the PC market was taking off and then the cell phone market, we generally stopped paying attention mm-hmm. to those other markets.
Now, you chose the PC market at a time, though, when people were not maybe spending as much money for PCs, because this is during 2008, right?
All of a sudden, high-end PCs disappeared. Mm-hmm. And for us, the challenge was that was our market, these, you know, generally over $1,000 high-end PCs. And if you remember, you know, the beginning of 2009, those weren't selling.
So then how did you pivot then from your market, which at the time was high-end PCs, to then mobile phones?
Really, the people that got us our start in mobile and really for the whole company in terms of the largest first orders was Docomo and Fujitsu out of Japan. The big issue, frankly, Jessica, was that our fingerprint sensor was ugly. Mm-hmm. If you literally could see and touch the fingerprint sensor. So the big focus when the downturn hit was if we really wanted to get into smartphones, aesthetics was incredibly important. And we started on this whole idea of how do we cover up the fingerprint sensor, right, so that you don't really see it and it aesthetically matches with the phone. And so I think really that gave us a big push, right, to eventually be acquired.
You went public in 2007, which was a big moment for you. I mean, here you are, a guy from New Jersey, and here you are ringing the bell at NASDAQ with your wife and three daughters. Can you talk about that moment for a second?
So it was freaking cool. When you take a company public, it's kind of like winning the Super Bowl. My daughters actually rang the bell to open the stock exchange. And, you know, every time I even say that or think about it, I get a little tingle, and I just had one. That was a great thing to share, you know, with my wife and daughters. And, of course, the team as well and their families who also came up.
When did you get on to Apple's radar screen?
Look, it's funny because people ask me how long does a design win take?
What does that mean? The design
win? Actually, the OEM or the customer saying, we will design in your product. So the honest answer is anywhere between about 3 months and 14 years. In the Apple case, look, I met with them in 1998. I don't even remember who. And then, of course, in 2012, they acquired us. And a year later, it came out in their, I guess, the iPhone, you know, 5S. So that, what's that, 14-year design in.
When you presented it in 1998, you probably were thinking about it for Apple computers.
No, that's exactly right. Because the iPhone nor the smartphones really, as a category, existed in 1998.
Authentic was sold to Apple in 2012, but you didn't know what they were going to use the technology for. And it wasn't until Apple made the public announcement that they had this new touch sensor in their phone that you found out that it was in the phone.
Yeah, right? I had no idea. I mean, obviously, Apple's a very confidential company. They certainly didn't share their secrets with me. And so I was just like everybody else. And let me tell you, that was, like, that was really cool. That was just probably as good as the IPO. And I didn't probably realize how big it was, like, of an announcement until my phone just blew up. Text, phone calls, emails, congratulations and great job. Really, I had nothing to do with the iPhone 5S or the Touch ID. I can remember a text from my daughter, my oldest daughter, who texted me something. I'm going to paraphrase, is not exactly right, but it was something like, Dad, how's it feel to, you know, really, you know, change the face of mobile technologies? From a girl that, you know, it wasn't that much earlier that she really didn't like me too much. That was neat.
You started off as the CEO and then stepped down. How was that for you personally? I see that a lot, you know, with founders having to step aside from a leadership role, and some take it gracefully, like, yeah, there's a better guy to lead this, and some take it, you know, a little more as a punch in the stomach. Like, where are you on that spectrum?
I was incredibly happy when Larry took over. I was burnt. I was completely burnt. And really, we had hired Larry, or I had hired Larry, who it took me 6 months to recruit into the company. Hired him before he went to the IPO, really with the idea that not long after the IPO, he would replace me. And I didn't really much like being a public company CEO. But that's when the 08, 09 downturn happened. So, you know, frankly, the board didn't want me to go. And Larry didn't really want to take over about right then. So I committed to, you know, stay a couple of years later. As part of another acquisition, it was really great that Larry stepped in.
Why do you think you were so burned out? I mean, is it just like inherent in a startup and an IPO and all of that energy and challenge that comes with that?
Yes. And it's like, you know, you finish this marathon and somebody's, well, hey, would you mind starting another marathon? And then you finish that marathon, and it's like, look, you know, I'll give you 5 minutes rest, but do you mind doing this other marathon?
I want to talk about your upbringing for a moment. You grew up in New Jersey. What did your parents do?
So actually, my father worked here in New York for a number of years. Unfortunately, in 1972, he was laid off from his job, ended up working in some bars, and eventually my parents were able to acquire their own bar.
What was he doing that he was laid off?
So he was, he was in technology, but if you consider technology typewriters at the time. So he was in a sales of typewriters.
There's a story that your dad, after he was laid off, pretended to go to work because he didn't want his children to know that he was laid off.
I can remember not only that experience with my father, but, you know, certainly back in that generation where they didn't want to admit something like that. So I can remember when he first told, you know, my mother. I can remember driving, you know, a couple neighborhoods over or towns over to go to a grocery store because my parents were using, you know, food stamps at the time and they didn't want us to see it. So I had great, you know, incredibly loving parents that really taught me well. They just fell on hard times.
I read about your father in a blog post that you wrote. This was on the eve of your having surgery for a brain tumor in spring of 2015. How did you even find out that you had a brain tumor?
I was having hearing issues, and then I felt a facial tick. Really just went to an ear doctor. If you're going to have a brain tumor, I had a good one, you know, in that it was actually not in my brain. It was just up against my brain.
And you found out that you had this tumor right when you were starting your new company and you had just returned from a trip to Rwanda, which was the inspiration for starting your new company. So a lot going on.
I had retired after, you know, Apple acquired the company. I told you I was burnt out. I was never going to work again. Went to Rwanda. I had been there before on mission trips. During the tour and the visits with various entrepreneurs in Rwanda, I met this woman. So I'm talking to her, and, you know, she had gone over right after the genocide, eventually opened up 15 different orphanages, started baking cakes for the kids for their birthday. Next thing you know, she's opening a bakery and baking cakes for people all over Kigali. And then she bought this coffee shop and she only employed battered women. I mean, it's like, geez, how great can your story be? She was talking about expanding her coffee shop and she said, I could use the proceeds from this to further God's will in other ways. So I went back to my wife. I was done being burnt out. I wasn't dead yet, had plenty of energy. And that was the whole idea that, look, let's, if we start another company and it is successful, we don't want the money. In fact, it would be embarrassing, but we could use it.
You could fund these projects in Rwanda.
And other places, right? So, you know, that was really the motivation for K4 Connect.
This is sort of like the Internet of Things there where
it's exactly the Internet of Things. So it's this whole idea of integrating various devices and systems into, to me, a system that's responsive to my needs.
Your first product still specifically with senior citizens and people with disabilities. And what was the catalyst for that specifically?
As I was really looking at where we were going to apply the technology, And actually, I was meeting with this guy on a completely different subject at a coffee shop. He had reached out to me on homelessness. And so after talking about his advocacy, he asked me what we did. And I told him, and it turns out he has MS. And he used the cane, but I didn't know it because he was at the coffee shop before I was, and it was under the table. As I introduced the subject, Eric stopped me, and he said, look, let me tell you guys why this is important to me. He says, the way I look at my day is when I wake up in the morning, I figure I have the energy for 1,000 good steps in my day. And how I use those steps defines the quality of my life. And then he pointed at us and he said, you guys can make my life better. And so, Jessica, I'll tell you, you know, for me, on a very personal level, it was an oh God moment. Like, if I felt called to start another company in Rwanda, like, it was unbelievably freaking clear to me at that moment that that's why.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jessica. I really appreciate your time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest has been Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentic. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.